Hi, I'm Natasha Moore from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear the Q&A session that followed William Kavanagh's 2016 lecture, titled The Myth of Religious Violence. You can hear his lecture in an earlier episode of this podcast, but here's William with John Dixon digging deeper into the topic.
Bill, thank you so much for that stimulating lecture. Lots of questions have come through, and I think we should just dive in.
Right.
And you just answer them as you see fit. So is the problem with war and killing simply an innate desire in humans to dominate other people?
Right. I think, and one of the things I say near the end of the book is that the problem is not religious violence or secular violence, the problem is violence, right? So we need to clear away these categories that are unhelpful and try to get at the root of violence. And that is something that I don't think I'm prepared to speak on with any great depth. I don't think I have a theory of violence yet. But that's something that we ought to be looking at. Actually, the closest thing I would have to a theory of violence would be the work of René Girard, who you may know was a French theorist who came up with an idea of violence, which is based on the idea that all desire is mimetic, it's imitative. So we desire what other people desire. This brings us into rivalry. And in order to defuse rivalries that would threaten to blow a society apart, we scapegoat people. And that's the kind of origin of violence. And he thinks that he actually became a Christian later in life because he thought that Christ kind of undoes that dynamic of scapegoating by revealing that the victim is in fact innocent and is identified with God. That's something like, I think, the lines along which I would want to pursue that. But before you can get to those kinds of arguments about what causes violence, I think you need to do away with some of these really unhelpful sort of binaries where you're only looking at half of the violence. You're only looking at so-called religious violence, and secular violence kind of gets a pass. I was asked to contribute a chapter to the Blackwell Companion to Religion and Violence, and I contributed a chapter called Why This Book is a Very Bad Idea, and the editor changed my title. But the point is that there is a Blackwell Companion to Religion and Violence. There will never be a Blackwell Companion to Secularism and Violence or Secular Ideologies and Violence.
Can I ask what they changed the title of your chapter to?
Oh, I think it was something boring like The Myth of Religious Violence or something like that, yeah.
Another question has come through. If religion is what we have bound ourselves to, the original idea of religio, and everyone binds themselves to something or to someone, can we say that humanity is inherently religious?
I want to avoid that term just because it causes so much confusion and havoc. What I would want to say as a Christian theologian is that everybody is searching for God, ultimately. Everybody is searching for transcendence in some way, and people find it in different ways. That's a kind of thick theological claim that, as a Christian theologian, I would like to make. You can make it in kind of less thick theological terms by just saying that everybody's looking for something, to quote the Eurythmics, right? looking for love in all the wrong places, as the country music song goes, something like that, right? That everybody seems to have this kind of drive that they're looking for transcendence. I mean, Sartre thought that this was true of human beings. He just didn't think there was anything there, right? But I think that's one way of putting it. If you look in Acts 17, for example, Paul chastises the Athenians for their idolatry, and he's horrified by this. But then he goes on to give this very sympathetic account of what's going on and saying that you're, in fact, groping for God, and you'll find him because God is near to each one of us, as your own poets say, he quotes. And something like that, I think, is a sort of sympathetic account of what I'm looking for. The book that I'm trying to write now, which I've been trying to write for some time, which is a sequel to The Myth of Religious Violence, is a book on idolatry. Because that's really, I don't mention the word in The Myth of Religious Violence because it's a book that I wrote for a secular audience. But I want to do the theology of it that follows on from that. And I think it's really a theology of idolatry that needs to be teased out. But again, idolatry in Paul's sense, that it's not just something to be critiqued, but that there's something true inside of it. It's a really kind of sympathetic account of the kind of seeking that the human person does.
There are people who commit violence in the name of religion, someone asks. Are you denying that there are acts of violence that would not otherwise have been committed without religion?
No, I'm not denying that at all. No, I had hoped to make that clear at the beginning of in my opening remarks about the lecture. No, I mean, it seems to me undeniable that people in ISIS commit acts of violence on behalf of their Islamic beliefs, right? Distorted, crazy, but on behalf of their Islamic identity. There may be other reasons, you know, political, economic reasons, and so on, are all kind of tied up in there, but I don't think it makes any sense to deny that that's the case, and I don't deny that the Crusaders were motivated by a kind of distorted version of Christianity either. But the question, what I do deny, is the idea that Christians and Muslims, for example, are more inherently prone to violence than someone who believes fervently in the advent of the workers' revolution or in the necessity to make the world safe for democracy by military means if necessary, and so on. We become very focused on deaths caused by bombs in backpacks, and we become kind of inured to bombs dropped from airplanes.
The term religion is obviously very problematic, but we still use it culturally, legally. How would you use the term then? Is it still useful at all?
Right, yeah, I use it as little as I possibly can. But I was kind of corrected on this. I gave a talk a couple of years ago to the political science graduate students at a very prestigious and very secular state university in the United States. And one of the students after the talk asked, well, what do we do with the term religion? And I said, let's just put it aside. It causes too much confusion. But later on, another student was saying, look, you know, we tried very hard for years to get this very secular university to take religion seriously in the international relations department. And here you are kind of pulling the rug out from under us. And I thought, yeah, that's right, actually. That's not what I want to say. What I do want to say now and what I do say is that we need to talk about religion as a lens and not a thing out in the world. So we need to talk about, I mean, it's we have that language and we can't ignore that. What we need to do is talk about the way that the religious-secular dichotomy works. And so religion is not that glass there. Religion is these lenses through which I see that out there, right? And the only problem with that analogy is that my glasses help me see better, and the religious-secular dichotomy usually makes us see worse. So I want to talk about where it comes from, how it's used, and be very kind of critical about that. There was another guy who came up to me one time and said, look, I teach in a religious studies department. Knock it off, right? That's my job you're talking about. And he taught at the University of Virginia, which is Thomas Jefferson's university, very Enlightenment-based and, you know, very secular traditionally. But they have this religious studies department, and they've actually got some really good people there who are doing theology. And so I thought, yeah, if the term religion helps theology to go on at Thomas Jefferson's university, then it can't be all bad, right? It at least gives us a foot in the door. So in other words, I think you just need to sort of be pragmatic about it. There are some instances in which the term can be benign or maybe even helpful, but for the most part, it's not.
One of the other questions sort of follows up on that. Do you think, given that religion is so vague and broad, should university departments of religion be defunct? Or, alternatively, it goes on, should they expand to study nationalism, Marxism, and so on, since they are religious concepts?
Right, yeah, I would favor the latter option, really. I think what a religious studies department ought to do is not study religion, but study the way the term religion and the religious-secular dichotomy has gotten constructed, and the way and the different ways it gets constructed and why. So in other words, a religious studies department would be one that is no longer just looking through the glass, but is starting to look at the glass and ask questions about it. So a self-critical kind of awareness.
If we can't ascribe violence to religion, is it just as inane to talk about the goodness that religion might bring?
Yes, that follows logically, right? I don't think you can make an argument about how great religion is if you can't make an argument about how bad religion is, right? What do you mean when you say religion? You know, what are you talking about? And can any two people agree on what it is that you're talking about? What kind of nonsense gets spewed in this way? I don't think that you can make arguments that religion is inherently peaceful either, right? What I'm really asking for is a kind of critical and empirical analysis in which you get as specific as you possibly can. I mean, any argument that you get where you start saying things that religion is like this or religion is like that is as silly as saying, well, politics are like this, or all men are like this, or Islam is like this. There isn't such a thing as Islam, for example, right? There's lots of different Islams. So what we need to do when we talk about, instead of talking about religion and violence, what we need to do is burrow down in and say, a lecture that I heard last week at that conference, the Girard Conference in Melbourne, a Muslim scholar gave a very detailed analysis of the sections in the Quran that talk about war. And she made an argument that in the early century or two after Muhammad, most of the interpretation of those passages lent themselves towards defensive war. And then when you get an empire based in Syria in the 8th and 9th centuries, then you begin to see interpretations of those passages in terms of offensive war. Now that's an interesting argument, right? Now you're burrowing down into the actual, and you're showing how contested these concepts are. But anytime you get people in a public conversation throwing around Islam, you know, Islam is like this or Islam is like that, then you're going to get distortions. Just as the same thing could be said for saying Christianity is like this or Christianity is like that or religion is like this or that.
Could you comment on the view that civil religion was fostered in the USA, particularly from the 1940s onwards, as a unifying political response to the so-called godless communism?
Right. Yeah, the part of the Pledge of Allegiance that says under God was actually inserted in the 1950s. The Pledge of Allegiance had been around since the 1890s, I think, but it wasn't until the 1950s that we said one nation under God. And that was done in 1954, I think it was, in specific reference to the communist threat. And so, I don't think there's any question about it that there was a kind of heightening of nationalism in response to the communist threat, but that's not the only reason, and nationalism very very much predates the kind of Cold War era, and it's not, hasn't gone away yet.
How do academics in this whole field respond to your, which was a very small part of your lecture, pointing out that the atheistic moments of violence in the 20th century eclipse religious violence by a factor of, well, that's could hardly put a number on it. How do they respond to that? Do they tend to do the kind of Christopher Hitchens thing and say, oh, that was religious violence too? Or do they concede it in another way?
Yeah, actually, that is something that wasn't in the book. I just inserted that into the lecture. And I don't know, it was just one of those things that didn't occur to me before. So I haven't had reactions to that specific point yet, but I would suspect that you would have to do something like Christopher Hitchens does and just say that, well, that's not really atheism, right? Atheism is me and my friends, you know, who are all very nice people. You have to do something like that. I mean, these arguments are so malleable. This is one of the, you know, you can certainly make an argument, which is made all the time, that having a God kind of ramps things up to a higher level. You know, if you feel like you're being told to do something by the God of the universe, then it makes things more intractable. You could just as easily make the opposite argument and say, if you think there's no God above you, then you become God and you can do whatever you want, as Joe Stalin seems to have thought. So these arguments kind of devolve into this kind of, these sort of nonsensical kind of generalizations.
Can I shift just a little bit and ask you to defend your entire discipline? Because many of the new atheists say that theology really isn't even a subject, because there's no God, so the study of God is just a ridiculous idea and shouldn't be in the universities. Can you just give us a sense of what theology is as a discipline and why you think it ought to be in universities today?
That's an interesting question. Theology is, as the name implies, the discourse about God. Even if you don't believe in God, I think you can see that there's rational kinds of ways of talking about the idea of God that can constitute a discipline of thought, which is an influential discipline of thought across history, and one which continues to exert influence. And so I think it very much belongs in the university, and I don't have, and I make no apology for that. It assumes, of course, something that you can't see and put under a microscope, but in that it's no different than history or English literature or lots of other, you know, philosophy, other kinds of humanities. The soul, which is the study of psychology. So I have no apology to make for that. I think it was considered the queen of the sciences in the medieval university. It's clearly been dethroned, but I think it's a unifying discourse rather than a divisive one, in the sense that it can make sense of other disciplines that they can't make of themselves. And this is something that's desperately needed in today's universities, in which the divisions are so great. I mean, students are naturally frustrated when they go in and discover in their philosophy class that they have free will, and then they go to their biology class and discover that they don't have free will. And what they tend to do is just parrot whatever the professor tends to think. And one of the things that theology can do is kind of provide a kind of unifying discipline. And I think that's ultimately that's more intellectually satisfying.
Can I pick you up with your analogy of religion being the lenses by which you view the world, and ask you more specifically about the lenses that Christian faith, let me make it even more specific, the Gospels, the person, the teaching of Jesus. In what way does reading the world through those particular lenses influence? Because you're surely not saying instances of religion have no influence on the way people view the world.
Oh, no.
So here's a specific one I'm asking you to answer. Well, you can take it academically or personally.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't mean to say anything like instances of religion have no influence on the world. The point I was trying to make is that this concept of religion is not something that exists out there like a rock that you can just bump into, right? It's a way of talking about the world. It's a kind of conceptual lens through which we divide things up in Western and Westernized societies. And that's what I mean by them being lenses. But by no means do I deny that this has an enormous influence in the world. And so does, of course, the more specific beliefs in the gospel have had a tremendous influence. I mean, this is, I take it as the point of the documentary that the center is producing, right? That the gospel has had an enormous influence for better and for worse over Christian civilization.
Will you thank Bill Kavanagh?
Thanks.
You've been listening to the 2016 Richard Johnson Lecture Q&A session with William Kavanagh and John Dixon. William is Professor of Theology at DePaul University in Chicago. He holds degrees from Notre Dame, Cambridge, and Duke University, and has worked for the Center for Civil and Human Rights at the Notre Dame Law School. His areas of specialization include political theology and economic ethics. He's the author of The Myth of Religious Violence, Secular Ideology and the Roots of Modern Conflict, and Field Hospital, The Church's Engagement with the Wounded World. Do also check out our other podcast, Life and Faith. It's a wide-ranging weekly conversation about how Christianity interrogates and illuminates the world we live in. You can find Life and Faith wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.